This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
Don't sweat the technique.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people. Some at the top of their game, others still climbing. All possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their vision. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
Don't sweat the technique.
Have HBCUs outlived their purpose? Is it necessary to create targeted programs for improving black male agency and success? Rapper and entrepreneur Dr. Dre gave USC a $35 million gift. What would that money have done for an HBCU? Today, I'm with someone who has unique insights on all of these questions. Widely regarded as a data-driven decision-maker and innovator at struggling historically black colleges and universities, who even shares his cell phone number with students, Dr. Walter Mark Kimbrough is the seventh president of Dillard University, a private historically black liberal arts college affiliated with the United Church of Christ in New Orleans, Louisiana. So let's harken back to 20 years ago. We decided to go back to the place where we met, the Dobbs University Center at Emory University. I was 23 with braids, and you, Walter, what? I think you were 26, and because of your great gene pool, you basically look the same, which makes me a little bit annoyed. But I am not ashamed to tell my audience that you, Walter, were a great big brother to me and kept my young, energetic, easily triggered self from going nuts often, and for that I am grateful. And for the way that you handled me alone with care and great counsel and respect, even if we disagreed, I knew that you were destined to be a college president. In fact, I remember having conversations with you about you charting that path. And so even then, you were a great diplomat, and you've proven yourself to be that today. So I want to offer you some popcorn and some sweet tea as we kind of reminisce about those days, but also kind of take my audience through how you, a young man from, you know, Southwest Atlanta who's a preacher's kid, becomes the hip-hop president. So I want to start with your education and your first jobs, because you, like myself, attended predominantly white schools. You went to UGA, Miami of Ohio, and Georgia State. And then your first three positions were at predominantly white institutions as well, Emory, Georgia State, Old Dominion. So can you tell me how these institutions kind of shaped you?
Well, you know, I take it back to K through 12 because, you know, I grew up in Atlanta. So I went to schools that were 98% black, you know, all the way through. So, I mean, I'm, you know, part of the black community, go to black church. You know, my high school class at Mays High School was an academy of math and science. So I was, I mean, we had some headbusters in my high school graduating class that went to all the military academies, the Ivy League institutions. So, you know, I grew up in that kind of very competitive environment. And so for someone like me, going to a University of Georgia was to have a different experience because, like, well, I've been around black folks all my life. Let me try something else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Georgia and then Miami and Ohio, which was really interesting because Miami at the time was 3% black, and I could go the whole day and not see another black person. So that was probably more of a culture shock because even at Georgia, it's large enough of an institution. And that's the thing, one of the things that people, when they concern about HBCUs, and just say, well, let's have everybody go to, you know, predominantly white institutions. In my 4 years at Georgia, I had very few meaningful interactions with white students. And the only meaningful interactions I had with whites were a couple of professors that I was real cool with, and then a person who was a coordinator of Greek life who sort of got me into higher education.
Got it.
But, I mean, I could live basically a black experience at Georgia just like someone could in any major city. You could live on the black side of town. Your kids go to black schools, even though it's a predominantly white city. So that's exactly what happened at Georgia. So, you know, in part, I know we'll talk about this, part of this whole idea of not having HBCUs create some kind of integration Where does that happen? It doesn't happen anywhere. I mean, like I said, I mean, blacks live in a lot of cities that are predominantly white, but they can have a black existence where they work could be mostly with black people. Their kids go to black schools. They go to a black church. They just live in a predominantly white city, and that happens every day all across the country. So, but those experiences were good, and in particular, and Georgia State, and you know, Georgia State was going through a transition at the time where it was becoming the most diverse, I think the most diverse institution in the country. Right now it's about 37% black, 34% white. I mean, it really is something that in higher education people haven't seen. So I was there at a time when that was really ramping up. But I think all of those were just important experiences for me in terms of understanding higher education, being connected with different people. So I just take those experiences for what they were, which all of them I think were powerful in different ways.
Sure. So was your appointment as Vice President of Student Affairs at Albany State a game changer for you?
No, not really, because I always knew I wanted to work at an HBCU, even though it's interesting. I mean, you know, being at a place, when we were at Emory, you know, black folks at places like that, really, I have a friend who used to say that, you know, at a predominantly white institution, the director of minority or multicultural affairs is like the president of the HBCU, and he's exactly right. Because you don't work in that kind of office, the black folks come in looking for you to have that kind of connection because they're like, okay, I'm trying to navigate this place. You know, who creates this space that makes it feel safe for me? And so and for me, Albany State, I always knew I wanted to work in HBCU to have that experience, even though I think there's great value for African Americans being predominantly white institutions, not just for the black students, but for white students. Who have never had meaningful interactions with black people in leadership positions. So I think that's important. But I wanted to be a part of an institution like that, but I wanted to come in at a level where I could make change immediately. And so I said, VP level, I got to come in at least at that level. So it was a good experience, but, I mean, I use the same skills that I use at the other institutions. People try to make them so differently. It's the same skills. Students are students no matter where they are. I mean, I'm convinced of that.
So the average college president is about 58 years old, and in 2004, you became president of Philander Smith College at the age of 37, making you one of the youngest at the time. During your time there, you were dubbed the hip-hop president, which is also your Twitter handle, Hip-Hop Prez. How did that moniker come about, and why did you end up embracing it?
Well, when I, you know, they introduce the president, and then you give your introductory remarks, and so you know, I acknowledge, you know, I'm 37 at the time, and I look like I'm 12. So, you know, I had to just go on and put that out there because that's the elephant in the room. Like, is this dude old enough to be a president? And I'm like, look, you know, I'm the average president is 58. I can't be like that person. They're from a different generation. They're boomers. They're veterans. You know, I'm from Generation X. And everything that's been written about Generation X, or the vast majority, it was a lot of negative stuff about Xers, you know, that the latchkey kids, the slackers, we didn't have role models or heroes, those kinds of things. I said, so, but I embraced that. I'm from Generation X. I said, I'm also from the hip-hop generation, which talks about black youth culture and being influenced by those factors. So that's how I'm going to approach this job as an Xer that's also part of the hip-hop generation. Well, there's a local weekly newspaper called the Arkansas Times, and so the next week their headline was Hip Hop President. And the media folks at Philander were just like, oh, this is horrible. You know, we don't want to have that. You know, and they're thinking, you know, profanity, misogyny, all of that.
Yeah.
And, of course, for me, when I'm in college and when I first think hip hop, I think Public Enemy, because those are the groups I listen to, which caused me at a place like that to learn more about myself because I wasn't going to learn it in my classroom. And so, you know, hip-hop for me, you know, groups like X-Clan, Eric B. and Rakim, they're saying some things and saying, you know what, I need to learn some more about me. And so it created that kind of space for me. And so I said, no, I think it's okay. I'm going to embrace this. And so I embraced it, and it just sort of, you know, just stood around with me, you know, which is cool because the average college president doesn't have, you know, some kind of brand, if you will. I mean, it's just like you're just the president. And so that's been important, particularly serving small, under-resourced institutions. That's been a way to get, you know, people to shine a light on those institutions when I don't have the money just to go out and buy massive ads. So I think it's been helpful.
Right. You are one of the first really branded presidents out there who has really effectively embraced social media as a way of connecting not only with your students but with the rest of the world. So that's been noted. I had the pleasure of serving on the advisory board of your social justice project at Philander Smith College. Why was it important for you to focus the campus and intellectual life on social justice while you were there?
Well, you know, part of it is when you get to a place, and, I mean, Philander Smith, first of all, it's in Arkansas. When I was moving to Arkansas, people were just, you know, geographically challenged, like, okay, so exactly where is Arkansas? You know, so people don't know anything about the state except for Bill Clinton,
and they
don't know much about the institution. So when we started going through to say, okay, we just can't be another small private liberal arts institution, you know, what's unique about this place? And for me, part of it was geography. I mean, literally 1 mile down the street is Little Rock Central High School, which is one of those critical events in the civil rights movement right after Brown versus Board. So it's like, okay, we're a mile down the road from Central High School. One of the Little Rock Nine has died now, but I've had a chance to meet all of them. And having conversations with them, they said even though we were able to go to Central High School, we didn't have full access to the facilities. So we had to come down the street to Philander to get tutoring by faculty and students. I'm like, wow, this is you know, very powerful to me. And you start looking around at some of the other things that were happening or had happened in Little Rock, and I said, you know what, there are a lot of you know, social justice-related things that have happened in this city. The other part of it is that social justice is really big in the United Methodist Church, and Philander is a Methodist school. And so pulling all that together, I said, you know, this makes sense. This should be the focus for this institution, and I bounced it off for folks. And it was an easy sell, particularly for the United Methodists. They were, you know, that was an easy win for them. They were like, this is great. So that's how, you know, that's how it came about. It made sense for to give that institution a unique purpose, and it fits particularly where the institution is located.
It was a brilliant move. I was really honored to be a part of that. So much say that the reason that you're going to be inaugurated as the seventh president at Dillard University next month is because of your reputation for diamondism and your ability to connect with young people and your proven record as a turnaround agent. How is your vision for Dillard unique to that institution, especially as a school still rebuilding after Hurricane Katrina?
Right. You know, I've been spending a lot of time talking to people here, and we're going to spend a lot of more time doing that too. We're completing the Katrina recovery phase, so we have pretty much only one residence hall, and it'll be open at the end of this month. And then we'll be back. We'll have her, but that's an 8-year process, and some people say that's long. I'm like, then come hang out with me. I'll show you parts of New Orleans that you see the blight at properties, and I just can't even imagine what it was like to be here 8 years ago. So for us to be back now, and then we have a sister institution here, Southern University of New Orleans. They just wrote an article about them, and they're really struggling. I mean, they don't have their library back yet. It's 8 years later.
Oh, my heavens.
So it's, you know, it's been really rough for a lot of places. So we've gotten to that point. Dillard is going to be unique because it was always viewed as one of these, like there were seven private HBCUs that they sort of called the Black Ivy League, and these were the ones that have always stood out. And so Dillard has always been a part of that group. So our, you know, history is different than a lot of other places. It's always been viewed as one of the stronger institutions. So for us now it's to refine, you know, what are we really going to be about? What are our strengths as an institution, and how do we really play to those? So I've been doing a lot of those kinds of things. You know, for example, physics. I mean, Dillard is, you know, number two in the country for producing blacks with undergraduate degrees in physics. I mean, number two in the country. So it's like we really need to talk about physics here because it's huge and we're doing a great job. So for us, it's different than some other places. We just really need to refine what are we going to be tremendous with doing. And everything else is going to be really good, but that's sort of what we're going to focus. And on top of that, then, how do we play a role in the two major ills in this community, which is the violence and education? We got to play a role because we can't just be here and not be involved in those community issues. So that's sort of the two-pronged approach I see for Dillard.
Wonderful. I have a Facebook question for you. One of the fans on our Facebook page, David Richards, asks, at a time when all liberal arts colleges are struggling, what is the rationale for young people of any race attending a liberal arts college?
Well, I mean, I think part of the challenge that liberal arts colleges are trying to make is that people are more concerned with what people are calling the practical arts. Parents are saying, okay, that degree in philosophy sounds good, but what kind of job are you going to get? I mean, right. They want to know, you know, so it's been more toward the engineering and those kinds of things. But when you start reading the surveys that come out every year of employers, what employers are saying that new employees are lacking are liberal arts-based competencies. They don't think critically. They're writing. They're speaking. And so if you go to a, you know, large institution and you have 1,000 people, I was talking to a student the other day at another institution. She's like, she's got 1,000 people in this freshman class. You're not going to have any meaningful interaction. You can go in there. You can hide. So you'll be a junior before you really will get into some courses where you can start to have meaningful interactions to develop some of those skills.
Right.
If you can go to a liberal arts institution and master those basic skills, you can do anything. I mean, there's a woman who went to Hendricks College in Arkansas. It's liberal arts, predominantly white, Methodist-related school. And she runs a major construction company, and her undergrad degree is, like, in theater.
Right.
So, you know, those are the kind of – so it's the skills that are important, but, you know, the challenge more so is going to be people focusing on the practical arts and then just the financial pressures of paying for a private college education. And so people looking for these greater economies of scale. But that, to me, is scary because, like I said, everybody isn't meant to be in classes with 1,000 people.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
There are things that you just don't get in those kind of experiences. So I think there is a value. We all have to figure out how do we provide that for people at a more affordable price. And the thing that I keep pushing back on is that if states can keep finding more money to incarcerate people at a cost of twice as much as what I pay or my students pay, there's money. So I don't want to hear there isn't money and you're worried about the cost of, you know, higher education, because we're not concerned about the cost of incarceration. We find money for that quickly.
Right, and that goes right into my next question for you. You wrote a pretty provocative piece for the LA Times when you learned that rapper Dr. Dre gave USC $35 million as a gift. I'm going to combine this with another question that I got from Facebook from Christopher Cager, who asks, why are HBCUs still having funding issues when blacks have a disposable spending power of almost $3 trillion?
Right. Well, you know, let me start with the Dr. Dre piece. I was at the University of Michigan speaking, which is interesting because they're a public institution with a lot of money, but they really operate more like a private institution. So
right.
We were talking about how they can really make a commitment to diversity, and I was telling them, you know, I looked at some of their numbers, and their percentage of black students is about 4%, and black men is like 2%, and it would be even less than that if you don't count the athletes. So a friend of mine, Sean Harper, who teaches at Penn, you know, he has looked at Division I athletics to say, people keep saying, we can't find quality, you know, black men as undergraduates. He's like, no, you don't ever have a problem if they can run a ball or they can dunk. You find those guys easily. So what if you recruited other black students like you recruited them? What if you spent millions of dollars to say, we have recruiters, we're going to send them out to these communities, go in people's homes and recruit these black male scholars?
Yes.
I said, in Michigan, you guys have the money. You could do it. You could spend millions of dollars a year if you want to just go and say, we're going to have the smartest black men in the country. You could spend the money to do it, but you don't have the will to do it.
Right.
Whereas I would, if I had the money and the resources to do it, I would. So it goes back to USC, which is the same kind of institution. You know, they haven't paid much attention to black students except for those who are athletes. And as Reggie Bush found out, they'll throw you under the bus real quick. So, you know, if you are viewed as an asset or a revenue generator, those are the kind of black folks that they look for. And that's not what I look for. I mean, my students are truly student-athletes because most of them know we're not going to be playing professional ball. This is a way for us to go to school and be engaged in other things. So for me, the Dr. Dre gift is like, okay, you know, dude, you from Compton. You could give them the money to Compton Community College. I would have been cool with that because they really need the money. You would actually do more for it. But I just asked the question in a broader context, you know, how much is your $35 million do with a school that has a $3.5 billion endowment, which is more money than all the HBCUs have combined. It's a drop in the bucket for them. I could take that $35 million, put it in an endowment, just spend 5% of the interest, and give $2,000 scholarships to about 200 students. Mm. That becomes more life-changing when I have about 1,300 students. You know, you could fund scholarships to a seventh of my students.
Mm.
So, I mean, it's just sort of like, you know, just in the overall theme of this country, we sort of have the haves and the have-nots, and the rich keep getting richer, and, you know, the poor, you know, are suffering. So we have these bigger gaps. And so even though African Americans as a whole have a great amount of wealth, I think we spend a lot of money on lots of different things, even though we're still in, based on people who look at philanthropy, African Americans give a greater percentage of their income than other groups,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody who is African American hasn't gone to an HBCU. I mean, and fewer have. So they're giving them to their church. They're giving through fraternals, rural groups. They're giving to a wide range of things. So HBCUs are you know, struggling, but it's not just HBCUs. HBCUs actually have been more resilient than, say, women's colleges have. There were 300
That's
women's colleges in 1960. There are about 45 now.
Mm.
You know, HBCUs haven't had any kind of drop-off like that. So I always push back a little bit when people say, well, you know, are they struggling? It's like private schools are struggling. Small private schools are struggling in general.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just a you know, a sign of the times and the nature of things that are going on. But those are the kind of ways that I look at it.
I want to trouble the waters a little bit more about this philanthropic piece with regard to HBCUs, because I know that a part of the conversation around the piece with Dr. Dre came from folks saying to you, well, he can give his money to anybody he wants to. And you and I have had this conversation before, because there are a ton of people of African descent in the United States who attended predominantly white colleges, like myself, who also have an affinity for HBCUs. I grew up down the street from Morgan State University. And
right.
I'm wondering if there's a way for HBCUs to make an appeal to people of African descent in particular about what their needs are and how not only financial resources, but just also sort of job training resources and career service resources would be really, really a powerful asset for your institutions from, you
yeah,
know, not
I mean,
only your
I think
graduates,
that's
whatever.
Part of the challenge to figure out how do we as a sector get people to say, I'm going to give to these institutions. Like I said, to me, it's probably more complex because, you know, a lot of people who give money as African Americans do so through church. That probably is the number one philanthropic, you know, area for us as African Americans. So that's a strong competitor for us, and I understand that. And so, you know, I always think that, as you know, how do HBCUs form strong relationships with churches as well, because that could be a source of support. But we've got to continue to find ways to say this is how the institutions are relevant. The opportunities we provide for the community, they've got to see more of that. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. There's some work to be done as well, but there's some opportunity. And I think just doing more cultivation within the African-American community and not keep looking for, you know, white philanthropists, because it's harder to get that money these days. So, you know, there are budding African-American philanthropists. So how do we tap them and show them that here are some ways that you can help, you know, people who look like you with some of your background and those kinds of things? That's probably going to be the next wave of philanthropy for HBCUs, I think, in particular.
You talked about this a little bit earlier, but I'm going to go back to your foundation a little bit, to your home base. You came from a lovely family. You're a preacher's kid, and you've created a beautiful family of your own with your incredible wife, Adria, who is an accomplished attorney in her own right, and your insufferably adorable children, Lydia Nicole and Benjamin Barack. Tell me a bit about how your family shapes you as a person and also how you approach your vocational path.
Oh, let's see. Well, you know, just shaped as a person, you know, a lot of that, I think, is just through the church.
Yeah.
Just being active, and you just sort of see with both parents, you know, active in the church and then in the broader community, since, you know, my dad is from Atlanta, so he was engaged in everything that happened in the city. So it's not just the church itself, but in terms of the politics of the city and addressing the needs of the city. So connecting, I mean, that's something you just growing up, and you know that anytime somebody's running for mayor, they got to come by his church. It was one of the biggest in the city. So it's like,
right.
We've got a place we got to be to connect with people, and then how he's able to help people connect and use the resources to better the community and the persons in the church, and then people who had needs who weren't even members of the church. How do we play a role and do some things for them? So I just saw a lot of that. That's important. But, you know, one of those things that happen a lot of time with preachers' kids is people try to put that on the kids and say, oh, you're going to be a preacher like your dad and all of that. And we heard that, but you know, we always push back. And as you get older, you really can determine what your own calling is. And then if you can be consistent with that, which I think a lot of people don't, that's when I think you can have some really good things happen. So for me to find, you know, higher education and working to help young people reach their dreams, that's, to me, that's a great, you know, calling to be able to fulfill. And so I can be consistent with the work that I do every day by doing that.
Yeah, and with your family, you and I are friends, and we've had lots of conversations, both personal and professional. And I think we've talked a lot about how having a wonderful partner who shares a vision with you for not just how you want to build your own family, but for the world is really important. And especially at a time where in our media, we just see all kinds of crazy with regard to black male-female interactions and relationships. Can you speak a little bit about how powerful it is to have a partner who, again, in her own professional right is astonishing, but she is such a stand for you and everything that you do as the First Lady of Dillard. And I've seen her in pictures, and the students always seem to embrace her no matter where you are. So tell me about the power of that witness as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, because we all hear the statistics for us as a community, and, you know, 67-70% of black kids born out of wedlock. You know, that's sort of inflated because there is other research that indicates even though they might not be married, that man is still engaged in the process. So, you know, it's said a lot sometimes to try to be used as a attacking point, but, it really is less than that. But there's still a significant number of young people who will come to college without having had a male figure or seeing what that family unit looks like. And so, you know, we were at Albany State, we would just hear a lot like, oh, y'all like the Huxtables. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, it was like funny to us. It's like, what are you talking about? But you get more and more, you hear that over time, it's like you get, you know, a lot of young people who have never seen what that looks like. Their view of relationships is just, you know, the VH1, you know, Love and Hip Hop. That's what they've seen as relationships. It's all been drama filled. So, at least for a lot of them, even though, I mean, when you talk to students, though, they still, whether they've seen it or not, they still want that. They have this idea of what they want in terms of family. Mm-hmm. So I think it helps for them to actually then have a chance to sort of see it a little bit, too.
Yes.
To be able to get a sense as to maybe how can I make this work, I think is important. So that's probably, you know, that's something you just have to be cognizant of, that people are looking to say, wow, that's something, you know, how does that work? And for them to see it, to give them some kind of prescription as to how they might be able to do it, too.
Yeah, not just your students, your friends, too. It's a beautiful thing to watch. I love it. Big question. If you weren't a college president, who would you be?
I was talking to somebody about this recently. I think I would be a journalist, either doing sports or doing editorials. I mean, you know, I like to write those controversial op-ed pieces.
Oh, clearly, so, and you do it very well.
Right, so I think that's what I would be doing. I think I'd be a journalist in some form.
Right. When my production assistant, Maddie Jacobs, sent you a list of questions, I was really struck by your favorite quote, because it's a quote that one of my future guests, Sherilyn Eiffel, she is the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and one of mentors. She shared it with me when I was going through a challenging transition. And your quote was, a prophet has no honor in his own land. I am really curious. I know why I chose it, but I'm really curious as to why you chose it as your favorite quote.
It's just, well, I think for me, some of that has been, you know, through some of the work I've done with fraternities and sororities, you know, you go to different places and you've written a book, and people just look at you like, you know, you stepped off of another planet, like, ooh. So it's like whatever you say, you know, it goes. And then you get back to your campus and people want to be hard-headed. And it's just like, look, y'all, I do know what I'm talking about. You know, so you sort of experience that all the time. You go somewhere else and you come in as an expert, but wherever you are, where your base is just like, oh, okay, that's just him, you know, which is why a lot of folks in higher ed, you know, you're always bringing somebody to say the same thing you would say, but they listen to it differently. So, you know, I'll go in and say stuff that the people on the campus have been saying for years, but it carries more weight. But they've been telling them the right thing the whole time. It's just you got this outside expert type person. So, you know, we see that a lot in higher education. So it just, you know.
Okay, well, speaking of that, you know, you have been a real vocal stand against hazing and hazing practices. Even I know that you're a very active member and respected member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, and I remember around your centennial, actually, talking to the leadership of your fraternity when you guys were facing those issues. And then FAMU's band just played, you know, their first game since their suspension.
Yes,
I think there's a sort of assumption that this is just a part of Greek life or a part of elite organizations on HBCUs, and you really have a problem with that. Talk to me a little bit about that as well.
Well, I mean, you know, hazing is just a higher education issue,
right.
Regardless of, you know, race or anything. I just did an interview about a hazing case with Pi Kappa Alpha at Florida International, I believe it was, where, I mean, you know, they're using drugs and hazing people and probably some sexual misconduct, and they got it all on Facebook. So it was just like, it's crazy. But this is, I mean, yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, regardless of race or whatever, it has been a problem in higher education internationally since the 1400s.
Right.
And it's just based on this notion of people that, you know, we're in the club or the group, and if you want to get in, you got to prove that you're good enough to be. It's just one of those, you know, human conditions that, you know, those who are in, I mean, you can see it with professional sports teams. The rookies have to carry the bags and do certain things. It's just we're in and you're trying to get in, so you have to do some things. And when you get people at that age of invincibility where they're in college and, you know, they test their own limits or test the limits of others, thinking nothing will happen. And then when something does, people are just sort of shocked, but it keeps happening every year. So it's just, you know, it's just one of those things that, In all of higher education, we try our best to manage. Whether there's a solution on the forefront, I haven't seen it. So, and I probably the longer I keep doing some of this work, the less and less optimistic I become. And it's just like, man, we're really getting into just a risk management type of mold versus hopefully eradicating the behavior.
Yeah, for your last question, it struck me that you are an African-American man who is the president of an HBCU. You are a father of a young, gorgeous black boy. And we faced as a nation the trauma of everybody's reaction, be it whatever side folks were on, with regard to the Zimmerman verdict upon the death of Trayvon Martin. You have been stand for black male agency, and you've actually put, you know, the institutional support behind it. What do you feel like is happening in our country right now with regard to the perception of black men, and what do you think other black men and other concerned citizens can do to empower not only just black men and boys themselves, but to change our perspective, to change our sort of knee-jerk reaction to how we respond to black men in America?
Well, in terms of, you know, I think about this a lot because it's interesting that, you know, black men with sort of this enigma, on one hand, you know, a lot of people have as their role models these black men, but they're usually entertainers or athletes, you know, that's sort of the school. I mean, I think it's sort of like the movie Do the Right Thing, and Spike Lee is in the pizzeria with the guy. He's asking him, like, you know, who's your favorite musician and who's your favorite, and he's naming all these black people. And so that's just one of the things that happens, that you have that, but then you have this same group that people fear, because in a lot of cities, when you have your 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock news, the images that you see of black men are mugshots. And you read the paper the next morning, that's the first thing that you see. I mean, particularly in a city like this in New Orleans, man, sometimes you just hate seeing the news, because you know what's when so-and-so got killed.
Yeah.
And they start showing the mugshots, you know how they're going to look. So these images, I mean, they're powerful. I mean, it impacts everybody, not just, you know, whites. It impacts black people, too.
Sure.
When you see a constant barrage of images that, you know, of these menacing-looking black men. So, like I say, it's just, it's crazy because a lot of people will have these black men as their most admired people, and then on the other end, you know, they're feared. So the challenge is, how do we, you know, move more black men from that potential person to be feared perspective to one that more and more people are admiring and those kinds of things. And so I think that, you know, as a country, how do we decide to make this important? And I don't know if the country's going to do it in the beginning, so how do we do it within our own communities? And so different groups have mentoring programs. I've done a lot with Big Brothers Big Sisters because that's another way to engage those boys and really help get them on the right path. I think all those things are very important, and it just can't be something that, you know, a lot of people just talking about, oh, we're doing this for the community. It's like, man, y'all ain't doing nothing. I'm not trying to hear that anymore. You know, how can we really do something meaningful? And even with young men that come to college, people feel like, well, they've got made to college, they've made it. It's like, no, there are a lot of fragile young men in college. Some of them are there just to get away from what's going on at home. They might not be there with that purpose to get a degree. They're just trying to get out of the house, get out of that neighborhood.
Right.
So then how do we take that person and then help them move to the next level where they're going to do something productive? So, I mean, it's something that we've got to, because you're going to have more and more of those Trayvon kind of situations where the guy, I mean, he is being profiled, and, you know, Zimmerman's looking at him as a potential, you know, suspect or someone who could do harm, you know. And like I said, some of that is created because they've had these burglaries and they've had young black men doing those kinds of things. So all that worked against Trayvon when he wasn't, I mean, he didn't live there. He wasn't up to anything, but all that worked against him. So,
well, that worked against him.
It's
got
to be something we all pay more attention to. We all have to pay more attention to how black men are looked at and viewed. So,
sure. Well, Walter Mark Kimbrough, stand for HBCUs, Accountability King, Fearless Higher Ed Innovator. Thank you so much for joining me as my first guest on the AY list, and for more importantly, for being my enduring friend.
All right, no problem. I appreciate it. Anytime. Thank you.
And special thanks to Barnett Carroll, Alan Spiro, Troy Johnson, Maddie Jacobs, and, of course, Tavis Smiley. Until next time, slay dragons and stay classy.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday and Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening. Don't sweat the technique.